outline your presentation, and we hope it does. You have 15 minutes aside. The yellow light will come on when you have 5 minutes remaining for rebuttal. You may proceed when you're ready.
Thank you. May it please the court. And if I may, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Section 312 of Kiowa is ambiguous, and the root cause of the ambiguity can be traced to the legislature's use of a term agreement in one place and the use of the term contract in another. Compounding that ambiguity is the fact that the legislature doesn't just stop with agreement, but also uses the term agreement in one place and an agreement to convey in another. The error that is germane to the district court's ruling is the district court lumped the contract and an agreement to convey all together and said they're one and the same. We know that's not the case. First of all, as a matter of common statutory construction, the legislature meant the terms to mean the same thing. It would have used the same term throughout.
So I'd like to ask you about the statute. I know that Kiowa, as they call it, when it was originally enacted, closely followed the language of the Uniform Act. But as far as the subsection 3, it was later amended fairly substantially to deviate in certain ways from the Uniform Act. And since you're arguing that the statute is ambiguous, have you checked to see what sort of discussions there were in the legislative history as to why those changes were made?
We have, Your Honor, and you're absolutely right. There were some substantial legislative modifications to Kiowa. As you're certainly aware, you know, another division of this court has held that Kiowa was a substantial adoption of the Uniform Act. And that's why we look to the Uniform Act for guidance in interpreting Kiowa. Now, there were some amendments to this particular section, both in 1993 and again in 1998. The 1998 amendments, in fact, broadened the power of the association, not the other way around, running to the owners and giving the owners more power, but broadened the powers of the association, specifically in Section 312, subparagraph 3. In one of our briefs, we discussed the fact that the power to execute and record the document that memorializes the owner's agreement used to have to be signed by all the owners. And very similar to Senate Bill 100, which passed a couple years ago, where the legislature said that we deem it necessary as a matter of public policy to streamline the management of condominium associations to make them more efficient. And trying to round up or, you know, herd cats with all these owners all over the place is too difficult. So the legislative amendments in 1998 that are relevant to your question, Your Honor, actually put that power into the association to then be the actor, so that the association is now executing that document, recording that document. Why is that relevant? Well, that is relevant because when we look down to subsection 4 and this question of ratification, which of course, you know, it trips everybody up the first several times you read the statute. You say, well, what is being ratified and who's ratifying? Well, we have to look at who is the actor. And the actor throughout this is the association, where it reads in the statute, the execution of an agreement by the association, the document executed by the association and recorded by the association. So when we come down to subsection 4, and it talks about the association contracting to convey on behalf of the owners, and then referring us in the phrase which has been pointed out in both of the parties' briefings, executed and ratified, we have to say, well, who is executing and ratifying pursuant to subsection 3?
Why would there be a need to ratify if the association is the only actor?
Well, and you raise another good point, which is, you know, we believe, based on the legislative changes, that it is merely a vestige from a prior iteration of the statute. That said, of course, we're certainly aware that we have to take the statute for what it is, read it within the four corners as it is written, to first determine whether or not there's an ambiguity that even allows us to look to extrinsic aids for statutory construction to figure out, well, why is this language there? And so looking within the four corners, I mean, we've identified quite a number of ambiguities that we believe open up that door that the district court did not open. The district court said, well, this makes sense to me because it just determined that the agreement and contracts are all the same. But once you understand that threshold question, that the agreements and the contracts are different things, it does create an ambiguity in the interpretation and both the application of the statute that requires us to look beyond the four corners of the statute to say, well, what does ratification mean here?
Pardon me for interrupting, sir, counsel, but I'm wondering if we need even look at this statute at all. I'm looking at your contract, the sales contract, and I'm looking at subsection 6D, which says no representations from seller. And it reads, buyer acknowledges that the property does not currently exist as a condominium unit and that only become a unit upon approval of an amended and restated condominium declaration and map of not less than two-thirds of the current owners of the project. Why isn't this simply a clause in a contract that buyer and seller have agreed to, and that we had a failure of this? It has nothing to do with the statute. Your clients were, the Platts were on notice that this was here, and they were on notice that there had to be two-thirds approval, but yet there wasn't. So why doesn't that end the issue without having to resort to interpreting the statute?
And I wish it was that easy. The reason why is this. Paragraph 9A of the addendum, which I believe is the section that you're referencing, which is captioned conditions precedent to unit interior completion, goes on to state the following, that not less than two-thirds of the unit owners approving this contract as required under Kiowa.
I understand that, but the prior section that I'm talking about, section 6D,
yes, sir,
has no reference to Kiowa at all. None.
Yeah, there are two parts in the contract that refer to the two-thirds. One references the statute, and the other one has no reference.
I will pull that. I don't have the contract in front of me, Your Honor, so I'll pull that when I set. But I believe that, you know, the contract was contemplating and put the Platts on notice that, as the trial court points out, weren't the Platts on notice that further action was required? Well, further action as required under Kiowa. And so the question creates a bit of a tautology, bringing us back to what is before us. Well, what does Kiowa in fact require? And if Kiowa requires a second vote of the owners, we lose, plain and simple. But if Kiowa does not require the owners to go back and approve the actual contract of conveyance, but in fact section 312 is only talking about has the contract been approved under section 312.4 as required, which I believe was clearly the intent of the parties who prepared the contract, saying we just want to make sure it complies with section 312.
Let's assume just for a minute that you're right and that there is no second vote that's required to ratify the contract for sale. Doesn't the statute, though, in subsection 3 nevertheless require that the agreement by the association be put into writing and executed in the form of a deed?
It certainly does.
And was that done in this case?
It was not. And so the question is, what is the ramification or impact of the association's failure to fulfill its statutory obligation of reducing the owner's agreement to convey into some sort of document? And our position is that, you know, they cannot hide behind the doctrine of prevention. The doctrine of prevention being one that says that parties cannot benefit themselves from a condition precedent in a contract that they themselves prevented from being fulfilled.
Well, under subsection 5, it says if all the steps aren't met, that the agreement is void.
And I think that is, well, it does. And it's a difficult provision, frankly, to reconcile with the association's failure to record the document. But it's a, fulfilling their obligation to record that document is something they could even do today. You know, there's no dispute that there was a vote and that the owners unanimously agreed to convey common elements, and that the association then had an auction. The Platts won it. The Platts paid their earnest money. The parties entered a contract. The contract was then subsequently amended. There was partial performance under the contract. And then at the behest of a board member who wrote a letter to all the owners saying, hey, guess what? We think you get a second bite at the apple. First you get to vote for it, then you get to vote against it concept. He put it back in front of them for another vote and told them in the letter, if you vote against it, then I can almost assure you that your special assessment is going to be less than what you're going to have to pay if you vote for it. So that segues into, you know, the additional claims that the court dismissed, being breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing, that we believe is a viable and meritorious claim, irrespective of, in standing alone from the interpretation of Section 312, that there was, you know, an interference with the party's performance, and that the owners and the association as a whole owed a duty to act in good faith and to try to carry out the terms of the agreement as the parties had documented. Otherwise, what we are left with here is an illusory obligation where, you know, under Section 312, as the association would have it, they are at liberty at all times to enter into illusory contracts with the public, whereby the public, as a buyer, is always going to be inextricably bound. The associations in the state of Colorado, apparently, will instead have the option, at their whim and discretion, to decide at some future date whether or not circumstances have turned either to their advantage or detriment, and whether or not they want to honor a contract or disavow the contract. We believe that the three sections of Section 312 spell out, once you look at the all the extrinsic evidence, specifically comment 2 of the Uniform Act, where the drafters tell us exactly what they meant in this situation, that an agreement needs to be memorialized by the owners. So they all raise their hand and say, we hereby agree to give the association the power to sell the common elements. The board then has a duty to reduce that agreement to writing under subsection 3 of 312. And then in subsection 4 of 312, the board has all power and authority to then enter a contract. And by entering that contract and by recording the documents, it has then been approved under subsection 1. The owner's agreement has been ratified and memorialized and executed in a document that the board is supposed to record with the real property records of the county in which the property is located. And the parties are bound to their agreement. And we believe that as this case plays out, and both as the statute reads, that Aspenwood is trying to evade their duties under the both under the contract and also under the statute. And that has been a substantially contributing factor both in their performance and their interpretation of the contract and the statute in preventing the parties from going forward under the contract. I don't have anything further at this time unless you have more questions.
You have about 30 seconds left, Mr.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, Mr. Thomas. My name is Maria Morrow, and I represent the Aspenwood Condominium Association, formerly known as the Upper Willows Condominium Association. I want to make it clear that I represent the 60 unit owners that comprise the membership of the Aspenwood Condominium Association, and not the board and not any particular faction. In 2006, the members of the association decided to sell a new unit they were creating out of common elements. The board negotiated a contract for them and entered into a contract with Mr. Platt to sell one of the new units for the amount of $531,000. The contract was sent to the members for a vote of whether to approve the contract in September of 2006. The members rejected the contract. The members were asked again in a meeting in early of 2007 whether they approved of the terms of the sale, and they again rejected the contract. That was in early 2007. So in this case, the court asked the question whether the members of an association have the right to review and approve contract terms on which their common elements are going to be sold. In the district court, we argued two bases for rejecting the contract as a matter of law. The first one was the interpretation of Section 312, which we believe is clear and unambiguous in allowing the unit owners to review an actual written contract and decide whether to approve and reject it. We offered a second and independent grounds for rejecting the contract, which was mentioned earlier, which is that the contract failed by its precise terms. The contract contained a few provisions, one of which referenced Section 312, and another which noted that the condominium unit needed to be created and platted, and in the absence of such a platting, the contract could not be conveyed. The addendum to the contract also had a deadline for the association to approve all those matters, and if they weren't done by August 2007, the contract terminated by its own terms. We offered, yes.
Oh, pardon me for interrupting you. Ms. Morrow, are you familiar with the concept of bait and switch?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Why would you offer a condominium to the public for purchase if it wasn't a sealed deal, if you weren't standing behind being able to, in fact, deliver the condominium?
I think that the best way to understand the process that goes on here is the concept of an agent negotiating for principal. The principal in this situation are the condominium unit owners who own this property as tenants in common. Under the common law, all of them were required to sign a contract, approve the terms, and convey it. And what you have here is an agent, which is the board, negotiating for its principal, the members. So there's no bait and switch here. The fact that the board was negotiating for members who had a right to approve the contract was disclosed to the Platts. The matter was put in the contract. The Platts were the members of the association, so they were aware that the board had taken the position that the members would be the contract would be circulated to the members.
Were they also aware that the unit owners unanimously approved the concept of sale?
Yeah, I think we need to. I think it's a good idea for us to talk about what actually happened, because the Section 312 distinguishes between what the board does and what the members do. The Section 312 discusses the association, which is the board, and the unit owners, which have a right to review and approve the contract. What Mr. Thomas has talked about in terms of a unanimous approval to sell the units is a January 2006 meeting of the members, which is in the record. What we know about the members, what the members did is this. We know they rejected this contract. So the question that you're asking is, prior to that, did they approve something that is an enforceable agreement to convey their common elements?
No, that's not my question at all. My question is, what did they do when they unanimously approved?
There was a motion in the meeting, and if you review, this is in the record at 321 to 325, and it's the most important thing that the members did. You'll notice that it was a general meeting of the members, and that in the old bit, there was no agenda item regarding the contract. So there was no discussion of the contract. There was no talking about price or appraisals or mechanisms to sell. In the matter of...
Ms. Morrow, let me cut to the chase. Isn't what happened here is that the condominium owners saw a way to pay for the renovation of the project. Mm-hmm. And the way they were going to do it is they carved out two condominiums from the common areas, and they all agreed, let's sell them.
That's right.
Well, since the plats were part of that, they must have entered the negotiation recognizing that all the neighbors, all of their neighbors, agreed with the concept in principle.
Yeah, they agreed with the concept to sell the units. The members had given the board a directive to go ahead with the process of trying to sell the unit. But there was never any discussion amongst the members about what price the board could do that at. So it's as if I go to a realtor and say, realtor, I want you to sell my property. I don't have some kind of contractual obligation to sell that for any price because I haven't given any specific authorization. There was never any discussion of price in front of the membership.
Who approved of the auction?
The members never approved of the auction. What happened, it's very important to distinguish between what the members did and the board did. January 2006 is the only time the members spoke prior to the contract, and the only time they talked about sale. And the only motion was, let's sell the units. No discussion other than that. Everything else happened at the board level. So then the board spent some time trying to decide what's the proper mechanism for doing this. Do we want to create favoritism among unit owners or do we want to offer them for sale on the open market? So the board came up with the idea that an auction would reach a minimum price, and they had an idea of appraisals at the time, and they did an auction. But the members had been told prior that they would have the right to approve the contract. When they opted into Kiowa, they were always under the understanding that the contract would be circulated. So the board then, in order to get a contract that would be sent to the members under 312, did an auction in-house, and that's how the plats got the unit. Then the contracts were sent to the members for approval. So it's really the members' rights.
Was the board represented in the trial court?
Yes.
Who represented the board?
I represented the board. Did the board have separate representation from the association? Is
yes.
That your question? No, they did not.
Ms. Morrow, regardless of whether we view this contract under the 6D section or under the statutory section, I'm going to pick up on something that Judge Graham asked you. The issue of the letter, in which the letter goes out and says, folks, don't approve this because you might be able to save some money on your assessments, doesn't that letter in and of itself raise some issues about whether there was fair dealing in the negotiation and the ultimate approval of this contract? Isn't there at least some question that a jury should be able to look at in that regard?
Well, when we think about the duty of good faith and fair dealing, we look at the reasonable expectations of the parties. And a party has to reasonably expect that the board members will provide even-handed information to the members in order to make their decision. And what happened here is a highly unique situation that you might not see in any other context, which is the board received the directive to sell at the January 2006 meeting. And at the time, they had information from realtors that the unit was worth in the $500,000 to $550,000 range. But then what happened during the following months as they did the auction and entered into the contract with the plats is that Related Westpac purchased Snowmass Village and obtained final approvals for development of Snowmass Village. And there was, as both parties agree, a totally unprecedented increase in property values in Snowmass Village. Properties sold overnight and inventory was depleted. And so what happened between the January directive to sell the units and the information the board received at the time of the contracting, which is that the units were worth $531,000, what happened was that by August of 2007, when the contract was circulated for approval, there was every indication that the contract was actually worth $1 million.
Yeah, but at the time that the contracts entered into, mm-hmm. I think it's fair to say that both sides of the bargain are saying this $541,000 figure is where we ought to be. So I'm having trouble understanding why there's not at least some issue for the jury about whether this letter represented an unfair pulling of the rug out from under the plats.
Well, we think as a matter of law, you have to look at the expectations of the parties and the context of what the law required. The law required is the first vote was put up by ballot. And as we cited in our brief, we explained that in a ballot measure, a board is required to provide written information that gives the members enough information to make an informed choice. And the property value of the unit at the time of the contract or at the time of the approval is absolutely material information that the members would have to have. So we think that as a matter of law, that you have to take into account the fiduciary obligations and the fact that the board has to give moderated information on both sides. There was a question earlier about the Uniform Act and what the Uniform Act required. In Section 3, there are some modifications, but I don't know that they are so substantial that they change the concept of what we need to do. Remember that prior to the Uniform Act, the way that these tenants in common would sell their real property is twofold. They would, everybody who owned the property would have to sign the contract. So prior to Section 312, 100% of my unit owners would have had to sign this contract. Second of all, it would have to be reduced to writing, signed by the party to be charged. That's an obligation under the statute of frauds. What Section 312 modified was simply the 100% requirement. You still have the statute of frauds requirement, which is reflected in Section 312, which is that it must be reduced to writing and signed by the party to be charged, but it only needs to be signed by 67% of the members now. In the Uniform Act, there's one significant modification, and that the Uniform Act said that the written agreement must be evidenced by the execution of agreement or ratifications thereof in the same manner of the deed. So the only thing that's different about the Uniform Act is the Uniform Act contemplates that you could circulate a contract and all of the members could sign the contract. Or you could do what the Colorado Act thinks is more practical and is more likely, that the contract would be signed by the association and ratified by 67% of the members. There would be no need to get signatures of every single member. So the Uniform Act is consistent. I want to make it clear that we're not taking the position that one or two or three votes are required. There are two ways to satisfy the statutory requirement. And what we need to do in this situation is start with subsection 4. This was a contract negotiated by the board. There was not unanimous agreement to terms. There was not a unanimous authorization that said, sell this unit for a minimum of $500,000. There was not, the members never said sell it for at an auction. So what you have is, what you have in section 4, the association, which is the board, on behalf of the unit owners, contracted to convey the real estate. But the contract is not enforceable against the association until approved pursuant to subsection 1, which is the 67% requirement, and executed and ratified pursuant to subsection 3. This is just like the Uniform Act. Either all of the members could sign it, or the board could sign it, and the members could ratify it. The statute of frauds requires that when you sell property you own as tenants in common, everybody signs. And all that Kiowa did was reduce the signature requirement to 67% and allow for a mechanism of ratification. Neither Kiowa or the Uniform Act can be construed to give a buyer the power to force unit owners to sell their real estate, which they own as tenants in common, on terms that are unacceptable to them. The process, then, to sell the common elements is simple. There's really two ways to satisfy the statute, and we're not saying two votes or three votes are required. You either need to get all the members to sign the contract to convey, and then the board has the power to sign the deed, or the board negotiates the contract, presents it to the members for ratification, and after the ratification, it's circulated. So there's not a convoluted process here, and it's not that much different than what was present at common law. It's a very simple process. I think also if we look at Section 4, it becomes clear what the board does and what the members do, and that's why it's so important that the members rejected the contract. They said in January 2006, let's sell it. And when they saw the contract, they said, we don't like it. Those terms are not acceptable. If you look at Section 4, it says 67 must approve, and then it says it must be executed by the board and ratified by the members. So you just can't force tenants in common to sell property on contractual terms that they don't agree to.
No, but you can't force them to negotiate in good faith.
You can, but one thing we have to remember, too, is that there's a distinction between I think if this was corporate property, property that was held in the corporate name, so let's say the Aspen Condominium Association purchased a small portion of property, a jungle gym. That property could be sold by directive to the association and by the association without membership vote, because you don't have the statute of frauds problem, which is that you have to have a writing signed by the member to be charged. And it's not real estate. And I also think there isn't an allegation that they didn't negotiate in good faith. There was no, the breach of the good faith and fair dealing was not an allegation that somehow this number was made up or it was illusory. There was a number that the board in its judgment believed might be acceptable to the members, but they told the buyer, they told the Platts, that they would send it to the members for approval. The contract disclosed this fact. The contract contained a provision that said you're advised to consult with an attorney. So everyone was aware that this contract would go to the members. And the other thing that's important to also understand is there's nothing that would have prevented the board from deciding to send it to the members if they chose to do so, regardless of what Section 312 required. I mean, in my practice, if there's a doubt or if there's a serious transaction, I think it's a good idea for a board to seek input or approval for their actions. And in this situation, they were selling real estate that was very important to the members, and they wanted to confirm that the price was acceptable. So regardless of whether Kiowa even required it, the board had the right to seek approval for their actions to make sure they were doing what the members wanted them to do.
Ms. Morrow, the red light means you're finished.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, we gave Ms. Morrow about an extra minute, so we'll give you a minute and a half here for your rebuttal to make things fair.
I'd like to circle back quickly to the question, Your Honor, that I'd been asked about the other provision in the contract. The contract does, in fact, require that the plat has to be approved and recorded. Well, of course. And that's a formality that is always required whenever common elements are being divvied up or any sort of homeowner association is revising its map. And it would be somewhat akin to a provision you might see in a title commitment where the title company says, prior to closing, the existing deed of trust has to be released. To release the prior note.
Doesn't this, Mr. Thomas, go a little bit further than that? Because doesn't it also say that the seller understands that this is not currently a unit and it won't become one until a couple things happen?
That's correct. And it has to be finished, replatted, and approved by the owners, and then recorded. It, of course, defies logic to believe that the owners are going to borrow all this money, create these units. The units then exist as non-legal units until the plat is recorded, and then they're going to refuse to do so, particularly once they've already entered a contract saying that they're going to sell a legal unit.
Well,
no legal unit can exist.
Such conduct may or may not be logical, but nonetheless, that's a condition expressly stated in the contract.
It is, but we don't. That's not why the association, repudiated this contract after entering the contract. They repudiated it because they wanted more money.
Do you have anything to say about the second part of the contract that also refers to the two-thirds vote?
And I would go back to the comment I made earlier, Your Honor, that the provision of the contract that says the owners also, the contract shall be put in front of the owners for their approval pursuant to the terms of Kiowa, or as Kiowa requires. And so the question is, well, does Kiowa in fact require them to approve the contract? Because if Kiowa does not require them to approve the contract, then I think this court's determination of what the statutory mandate of Section 312 is would trump that provision because, in fact, Section 312 doesn't say that the contract has to be approved or ratified by the owners.
But there is a reference to ratification in subsection 4.
There is a reference to ratification in subsection 4, and what does it say? Executed and ratified pursuant to Subsection 3. Subsection 3 makes no reference to ratification whatsoever. It used to. until the legislature amended the statute and took the language of ratification out of subsection 3, which creates this anomalous interpretive confusion.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas.
Thank you.